Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Good day to you all. It's Oliver on the air until 10. It is now Wednesday, the 13th of August, and the southwest down there, you can look forward to an AC/DC afternoon of thunder. Hot and balmy and barmy weather for the rest of us. But we're at your service today, whether you're sweating, fretting, betting, or wetting your flowers. Flowers, I said. Yes, the WhatsApp is open, 087-032-3232. And for your longer letters, you can always email oliver@rte.ie. Yes, yes. We've actors and musicians on the show for you today. We're going to meet a little girl from Wednesday. Do you know Wednesday? You should, because Wednesday is the biggest ever Netflix series. It has beaten Squid Game, Stranger Things. It is simply enormous. And there's a little Irish girl in it because the second series began on Friday. It is already in the top 10 worldwide. People are watching this like mad. It was made entirely in Ireland about a year ago. Everybody who worked in TV and film crews worked on this show Wednesday. And it's very exciting for us to watch because the first four episodes are out and you can see potholed roads around Wicklow and very Irish kind of feeling to it, particularly because the first series was made somewhere else on the continent, I believe. But anyway, a little girl from Tala was chosen to play the childhood version of the lead, who's played by Jenny Ortega, virtually unknown 2 or 3 years ago. She's now one of the hottest stars in Hollywood. Emily Ring is her name. She's 7 years of age and she only recently joined the casting agency when she got this role in The Biggest Thing That's on any streamer anywhere in the world. And apparently she manifested this role. So we'll hear from her and maybe the mammy, Margaret, who's out in Tala as well. And what an appropriate time to do it, of course, Wednesday, of a Wednesday morning, naturally. Naturally. It's kind of a scary thing. This is the intro for it. And picture all the dark woods and the thing, you know, the disembodied hand wandering around. So I don't think little Emily has watched any of this, safe to say. And if you don't know what it's about, it's the kind of solo tale of the little girl from this show. What a theme tune. That's the 1965 Addams Family. But the whole thing began as a comic strip in a newspaper by a fellow called Charles Addams. Two D's, not associated with the Addams that we know. Anyway, 515 is the text. Yeah, 51551 is the text. So many numbers to remember. The news sites today carry all the pictures of the heat wave, the fine weather to continue. Apparently yesterday was likely to be the warmest of the hot, humid, sunny week that we're having, according to Met Aaron. And of course, thunder is on the way now as a result of those hot temperatures. But we don't get the dramatic storms that we learned from our storm chaser because we don't have the dramatic heat. And other places do have pictures of the wildfires erupting across Europe because they are deadly high temperatures and there have been deaths and there have been people suffering from heat stroke and it's all very scary. Again, second kind of heat dome you've had across Europe. However, the Telegraph in Britain is asking, is everyone getting a little bit OTT about heat warnings and the heat domes and smothering and basically kind of we're grazing the edge of it, but are we losing the run of ourselves? And they're talking about heat waves of the 1970s. This is a fellow called Nick Harding. He says he was a child in the 1976 great heat wave. And he says, we wear it now like a badge of honour. He was 7 years of age, survived with just a carton of Kiora, an ice pop and a smattering of Hawaiian Tropic Factor 2 tanning oil on a seven-year-old. Normal in 1976. Other journalists kind of writing about this saying there were literally casualty doctors who issued the health warnings for the country. The temperatures now were nearly 36 degrees. It was a June record at the time in South England. And the casualty doctor said, one of the best things you can have in this weather is a pint and a packet of crisps to replace the salt. Also, a string vest is ideal. Because it wouldn't be kind of sticky, you know, it wouldn't have the kind of dragging or sticking sensation caused by the sweat and so on. And the crisps was all about you lose important electrolytes like sodium through your sweating. And this would be replaced with salt, of course. And back then, they thought crisps was the best way to do it. Not the healthiest idea now. The government also advised at the time in 1976 related to water rationing and not surviving the heat was water rationing was share bath water and only flush the number twos for using the toilet. And direct public health messaging only became standard after 2003. And that was staying indoors and drink fluids. Because, of course, the people who grew up in these era, born post-Second World War, right up to the late 70s, didn't go around carrying water bottles to school or to work. There was a water fountain here and there, and that's what they did. And nobody enjoyed a holiday back then until they came home with terrible burns. In 2025, the heat wave warnings are everywhere now. Take drinks in public transport. Stay inside. Test the pavement temperature before you walk your dog. Schools are banning children from playing outside during heatwaves. Even Glastonbury provide dispensers of free sunscreen. You can't walk down the street without seeing five types of people with hand fans. Have we all gone heatwave mad? And this rather cynical kind of we're all very soft now article takes quite the turn because the journalist Nick Harding spoke to a lecturer in human environmental physiology and gently reminds him that in 1976, 700 extra deaths were recorded in Britain that year from the heat. And in the record-breaking summer of 2022, nearly 3,000 deaths were associated with the heat. So now he's saying, despite all of that, we're probably not taking the warning signs seriously enough. And while we might roll our eyes at the constant warnings, we really should be taking better care during the heat waves. The climate projections are terrifying. Air temperatures that we're experiencing are going up exponentially and have done in just 5 years. And some climate scientists are suggesting that in only 5 years' time, we realistically could get over 50 degrees Celsius in London every summer. That is extraordinary. And there are separate articles elsewhere in the British press, which is about unions pushing for basically mandatory downing of tools, particularly when it comes to manual labour during heat waves. And these are safety plans that are being drawn up right now because of the heat domes that are just coming in waves every year and now more than once a year. Bin men, builders and others doing this kind of strenuous labour would be able to demand extra protection during hot weather. Under the proposals, it would be a maximum working temperature of 27 degrees for manual jobs. So if you're outdoors doing a manual job, you stop working until the temperature goes back down again. Britain is experiencing its fourth heat wave of the year. We haven't officially had a heat wave yet. That's five consecutive days of 25 degrees plus. They've had it four times. And the Met Office, in keeping with the climate scientists, are saying that in the very near future, this is within 5 to 10 years, summers will be at 45 degrees very, very regularly across all of Britain. 50 degrees for London because it's in the southeast and so on. So it's extraordinary stuff. And there is precedent in continental Europe for this maximum working temperature. Greece this summer announced that manual workers had to take a break between noon and 5 p.m. all through the summer. And in Spain, Italy, Germany, they have maximum temperature rules and they stood down road workers and other people working outdoors, construction workers and so on, when the temperatures just went so high. So Ireland, more and more, becoming an attractive place to live. We just forgot to build stuff that people could live in, really. But there's loads of offices and amazing amounts of empty, flashy retail units. Can we just move beds in there? Inevitably, says you. What else is happening to distract us from all this absolute terror? Ah, tennis. Yes, tennis will do. Can they play tennis? Oh, no. Struggling to keep her cool. Very good. Appropriate headline. This is Emma Raducanu, who's the British tennis star. And she was very angry during a match. It's the Cincinnati Open. And she ended up getting knocked out. It was a very narrow defeat. Third set tiebreaker. But during the final set, she's a Grand Slam champion, don't forget. She prepared to serve and she heard a sound in the stands that broke her concentration. It was a crying baby. She walked away from the baseline and she just had enough and she goes to the chair umpire. She says, look, it's been like 10 minutes listening to this and this is what the umpire says back to her.
It's been like 10 minutes. It's a child. Do you want me to send the child out of the stadium?
That's the crowd saying yes.
I can call in, but we need to continue for the moment.
Continue for the moment as she did call people and the child, the mother, parent, the two parents and the crying baby were removed from the venue, which is kind of extraordinary, obviously, has erupted all sorts of discussions about it. Emer O'Hagan, who must be an Irish journalist, writing in the Metro in London this morning, says she was right to get a crying baby kicked out of her match. I commend Emma for finding the courage to speak up and complain about the noisy tot. Or rather, it's entitled parents who seemingly were perfectly content to allow it to disturb a highly pressurised sports competition, the concentration of the players and the enjoyment of the crowd who had paid through the nose to get there. And she thinks she's using the word courage deliberately because it's not easy to do what Emma Raducanu did in full glare of the telecameras, risking the wrath of all the other parents watching, who, as Emer says, see no issue with allowing little children, through no fault of their own, wreak havoc on the enjoyment of others. My new sporting heroine is Raducanu. Give her all the silverware. Which I'm sure is a comment which won't divide anybody at all. It was an audibly crying child. You could even hear it in that clip there. And you're trying to serve and win, and she doesn't win. Furious. Furious she is. What's this about Jimmy Kimmel? Jimmy Kimmel has revealed he's acquired Italian citizenship because of Trump's presidency. And he's the latest in a little mini wave of celebrities who are making other plans to leave the country because they have the money to do so since Trump came to power. Well, they're taking their sweet time, aren't they? He's been there now since January. We know everything. He was on a podcast with Sarah Silverman, and he confirmed this news, which had already been leaked by an Italian news agency. How does he qualify for it? Well, basically, he says his grandfather's parents, that's his great grandparents, wouldn't it be, moved to New York from an island off the coast of Naples after an earthquake in 1883 killed most of their family. Extraordinary. And he says his grandmother, whose family came from Canada, she came from another part. Sorry, it's the province of Avellino. It's Candida, the place in Italy. Sorry, not Canada. That would make sense. So he follows Rosie O'Donnell. She's moved to Ireland. He's got citizenship. He hasn't moved yet. Ellen DeGeneres recently confirmed she and her wife, the actor Portia de Rossi, relocated to England, the Cotswolds, because of Trump, although there was unpleasantness in our show that was revealed. And so he's going to be the latest of it. And Trump will be very happy to see Jimmy Kimmel leave because, of course, he was expressed his delight that Stephen Colbert got fired, saying his talent was even less than his ratings, which wasn't true because he was the highest rating person. And I hear Jimmy Kimmel is next. He is even less talent than Colbert. Colbert will be scouring France for relatives. But of course he has them in Cavan. Colbert's from Cavan. God, that was a near miss now for Monaghan, wasn't it? Not to find him. Speaking of Trump, as you know, the US and Russia will hold a meeting between President Trump and Vladimir Putin of Russia in Friday. It's happening in Alaska. They're to discuss how to end the war in Ukraine. So far as we know, Putin is kind of everything he wanted, you know, because Trump has chickened out on his 1st of August deadline where he said Russia must agree to ceasefire or crippling sanctions, we're going to destroy them. What are the sanctions? Are there any business still left there? And then he said, oh no, I won't do the deadline now. I'll just meet him and we'll do a nice photograph. Putin then said, yeah, I'll go, but I don't want your man Zelensky there. You know, the man who's president, democratically elected president of the country I've invaded many times and continue to do so. Don't want him there. He got his wish there as well. The meeting is going to be in Anchorage, the capital of Alaska. And there's historical resonance to the US-Russian summit because the Americans purchased Alaska from Russia in 1867. How much did it cost? $7.2 million. This amounted to roughly 2 cents an acre. And initially, the guy who did the deal, William Henry Seward, was the Secretary of State at the time, and they called it Seward's Folly or Seward's Icebox by the Americans, who doubted the value. They said this is a waste of time. Why do the Russians want to sell it? There was big cost, logistical difficulties of supplying the territory, and they were struggling with debt after the disaster that was the Crimean Wars for them. Incidentally, Crimea invaded by Russia since then. Oh God, history just never ends, does it? And the Americans were kind of, we actually think this is a good idea. Why? Because they felt this would be the next step to annexing Canada, some more. All 1867, still all the same topics of today. And most of the Russians who were living there at the time, they weren't permanent residents, they left. They were offered US citizenship within 3 years, but most of them just left the place. And then eventually Alaska becomes an official state in 1959, which took a while. So Russia says the venue is very suitable, the two countries are neighbours, because only the Bering Strait separates them. It's 88 kilometres wide at its narrowest point, very close indeed. The closest spots are actually the Diomede Islands. Little Diomede is American, and the Big Diomede is Russian. And they're only 4 kilometres apart, these two islands. You can literally see one from the other. And the international date line runs between Little and Big Diomede, which means they're a day apart because of that rule there. The Russian side, it's just the army, military outposts since the Cold War. But on the American side, there are 100 residents there, mostly native Inupiat people. And they live in the western side. They rely on their own hunting, fishing, and occasionally get deliveries there. There's no harbour, no helicopters. Well, helicopters come every now and again, and they have seasonal ice runways. So the helicopters land on Icy Runways. It's kind of extraordinary, 100 people there. And obviously in wintertime it freezes over and the gap gets smaller, and historically before climate change they could literally walk across between the two of them. Somebody swam as a challenge, but it's not legal anymore to pass between the two places because it's Russia and America. So actually, when you think of it, when Sarah Palin said all those years ago you could see Russia from over here in Alaska, she was speaking the truth. Although we'll never forget Tina Fey having all the crack in, it was a 2008, I'd say it was, I'm putting a guess. And Kate McKinnon was playing Hillary Clinton in this memorable sketch from Saturday Night Live.
You know, Hillary and I don't agree on everything.
Anything. I believe that diplomacy should be the cornerstone of any foreign policy.
And I can see Russia from my house.
That's an unforgettable line, which she never. Most people think Sarah Palin literally said, "I can see Russia from my house," and how we laughed at Sarah Palin and how dangerous she seemed back then. But now she seems like a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist compared to that melting detritus of bacterial life form that accounts for many American political voices today. Dear God. Now, one thing that'll cheer you up is a good property story. We love a good property story in this country. Imagine a very, very posh neighbourhood of mansions in beautiful California. It's North California. It can be nice and warm, but it's leafy. It's nice and green. Very serene place. For decades, the Crescent Park in Palo Alto. This is a beautiful kind of city location south of San Francisco. Absolute dream. Doctors, lawyers, rich people rubbing shoulders. Stanford University professors living in big historic homes under oak and redwood and magnolia trees. And the families all became friends. They'd have little street parties. And then outside of that, the roads were dead quiet. Kids riding their bicycles around safely, playing in each other's gardens. And then Mark Zuckerberg moved in. And the New York Times has been reporting details of how the billionaire Facebook emperor lives in California and what he's been doing for the last about 11 years. So he, as you know, he controls the communications of about 4 billion people on the planet, thanks to WhatsApp and Instagram and Facebook and all of that. One of the most powerful people ever. In fact, his data centre in Ireland uses the same electricity as the population of Cork every day. And don't forget the water. I think roughly the same water that all of the people of Dundalk use every day. So the same electricity as Cork. And water. Have I said the wrong way around? Maybe I did. So we forget the water part of the data. Anyway, man worth. He's worth $250 billion or so on. And he has basically been spending $110 million, nothing to him, to scoop up 11 of these mansions. He's paid $14 million for some of them. He offers double, triple what the homes are worth. And the neighbours have just watched one family after the other just disappear and leave. So he has got these 11 mansions now in this old, once friendly neighbourhood. Most of the properties are sitting there empty. He just leaves these mansions empty. He's turned five of them into a compound, all linked. There's a main house for him and his wife, Priscilla Chan. They've got three daughters and there's guest homes and lush gardens and so on. But he's left most of them empty. He's demolished quite a few of them as well. And underneath, he's built basements, although they've been called kind of like a bat cave for a billionaire. One of the houses is being used as a private school for 14 children, even though it's not an allowable use of a house in the neighbourhood and in the city code, but nobody's doing anything about that. So you've got all these giant bunkers. That means the neighbours, their lovely neighbour, they've had 8 years of construction noise. There's also this intense surveillance. Cameras pointing at his homes have views of the neighbours' windows and gardens, they say. He denies all this. There are private security guards roaming around, sitting in cars. Sometimes they leave the engines running. They're filming the visitors who come to various houses, asking people what are they doing as they're walking on the footpaths. Most of the people are just residents. And they're saying, look at his spokesman saying, himself and his wife require very heavy security because of very specific and very credible threats to him and his family. And they're saying, we give the staff free taxis so they don't park in the area and so on. But the neighbours are very angry because they're saying he's taken over what was a neighbourhood. He could have just built a compound anywhere else with more space, as the other tech titans have done. And they're angry the council's allowed him to build the compound. They're angry at the police because they give them permission to close off sections of the road and so on. It's just amazing, isn't it, how these guys live? It feels as if they say the city officials and police officers give extreme deference to Mark Zuckerberg at the expense of everybody else. What else? He doesn't even live here all of the time. He has 2,500 acres on a Hawaiian island where he's building another compound with two big mansions and tree houses that are connected with rope bridges and shelters and so on. He's got a third compound in Lake Tahoe and he paid elsewhere $23 million in cash for a 15,000 square foot mansion in Washington where he can be close to the Trump administration that he's become very friendly with. And of course, recently in this country, we learned from the US billionaire John Malone that he wanted to buy his estate in Ireland. John Malone paid $28 million for Castlemartin Estate in County Kildare in 2014. The previous owner was the late Tony O'Reilly. But so there are the circles they move in. But sure, look, who are we to judge in this day and age? But I thought it would cheer us all up to know that Mark Zuckerberg, his neighbours don't like him either. He doesn't care. He doesn't even notice. Some people are texting in that I'm wrong about Anchorage. Anchorage is not the capital of Alaska. It's Juneau. Thank you, Aidan in Roscommon, who knows his geography very well. Top marks there. On the crying baby remark with Emma Raducanu, got the baby kicked out of her tennis match in Cincinnati. With regard to crying children and entitled parents, mass in our local church is ruined by the same noise most Sunday morning, says Martin. They're trying their best often, though, aren't they, crying? I don't think mass is mass without a crying baby somewhere clattering in the distance. And if a guy in a tennis tournament shouts something, the chair umpire says, quiet, please. If the guy continues, he'll be asked or assisted to leave the stadium. So the same should apply to the parents of an audibly unhappy baby, says Mick. All coming down on that one side, basically.